You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Robert. How are you? You're in a different location.
I am in a different location, a secure undisclosed location. That's an increasingly unrecognized allusion. You probably recognize what it's in.
That phrase undisclosed location. Is it a Cheney remark?
Yeah, Dick Cheney, right after 9/11. That's all they would say about him. He was in a secure undisclosed location. So let me introduce
him. Do you know what other reference, the Dick Cheney reference that comes to mind?
Shooting a guy in the face while hunting.
There's that. It's also man-sized safe.
They're
doing some sort of inventory of
his. That's how safe they kept him in a secure undisclosed location? Or he had a safe.
Sort of document, and it included a man-sized safe. Which you could open it up and put a man in there and then lock him in there.
Well, Donald Trump could have used that. Sounds more secure than a catering truck. But we digress, Paul. I haven't even introduced us.
Go ahead.
I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. I'm also author of the very recently published book on AI, The God Test, Artificial Intelligence.
You published a book on AI?
Yeah. I'll talk to you about it.
You should say something about that to all these people.
Oh, look, are you mocking my self-promotional tendencies? Because I don't even have them, man. I have to get up in the morning and psych myself up to even mention a book I've written. I am not that bad. I'm sorry.
It's a wonderful book. It is a wonderful book. Sorry for teasing you.
That is going to be immortalized in a blurb, and you can't take it back. But
no, I would not want to.
Thank you. That too will go in the blurb. I would not want to take this back. People can read excerpts and or the introduction at thegodtest.net, but I'm not inclined to self-promotion. So let's talk about you, Paul Bloom. Famous Canadian psychologist, globetrotting man of mystery, author of many important books ranging from indictments of all human compassion and empathy. No, that wasn't it. You did write a book called Against Empathy. Which is justly famous, and many other books. And you are the proprietor of the Small Potatoes newsletter and intermittent podcast. I mean, this being the main podcast that shows up on your newsletter, right? Do I have that privileged position?
It definitely is. No, go ahead.
Afraid the praise was coming to an end, so I'm not sure you want me to keep talking because I was about to shift into candor mode. Maybe you should cut this off.
Okay.
So we're going to talk about AI first, and then...
it's like a bad first date, isn't it? We're having problems sort of getting in a rhythm.
No, this is the spontaneity and organic quality that people flock to this podcast for. They are tired. America is tired, Paul. Of these canned, heavily produced podcasts where people say coherent things and make interesting points. This is real. This is raw. This is happening. And you are freezing. Oh, no, you're not freezing.
No, I was just extremely still while I'm processing the idea. This is this raw material. This is like the found footage of podcasts.
You know, my initials are raw. Robert Allen Wright. Did you know that?
There is no end to what we could do with your name. You know,
no end to the amount of time we could spend talking about me rather than things that people actually care about. No, let's move. Let's move to things people care about.
When I clicked on to the Zoom thing to get to talk to you, it had a different page, and the page said something I didn't read it, that this is now assisted with AI. I'm not sure what AI will do. It will record it. It will take notes. It will edit our...
Zoom. I mean, everything has this now. I'm so sick of running into offers to do something with AI that get in between me and the interface I'm actually looking for that I'm just about to go Unabomber. Not really. But
yes. AI is quite the topic.
It is. And, you know, so, last time, well, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Are books dead? Is AI killing books? Yeah. And I think we're going to start out going a little further and asking, is AI killing human writing altogether? This is hinted at or at least as a topic, by this Brett Stevens column in the New York Times that you directed me to. And I don't know, maybe other things are pointing you toward it. Have you found that really there's no need for Paul per se to do any writing now?
So, like a lot of professors, I have my complaints about AI assisted writing because it makes it very easy for my students to cheat. And my students have cheated using this. And it has caused no end of trouble. And I can't give any details on this because, you know, but it is, I have to now change my courses so they don't have take home essays or take home reading responses. And, you know, that's a minor inconvenience for me, but I think it is really going to damage the. I do think, and this is something Brett Stevens said, when Brett Stevens, we're jumping ahead here, but when Brett Stevens said, you should not use AI for any writing, he's very careful. He said, I'm not saying this for ethical reasons. It's if you are honest about it, there's nothing wrong with using AI. I'm not saying that because you're a better writer than AI. Probably you aren't, or at least you won't be in a couple of years. Right. I'm saying this because writing with AI corrodes your ability to think and your ability to write. And it is actually an important skill to be able to write. And I do believe that in general. I think he goes too far in his suggestion, but I do believe that in general, which is why I think the standard thing, which we've had for a very long time, where we tell students to write essays or reading responses, is really valuable. And taking that away from them is going to be a negative from their educational goals.
I think that's true, but I think there are challenges one could still make to that line of argument. Not that I really feel like making, but you kind of have to deal with them. And in a way, they come back to this larger question, you know, facing higher ed, which is like, what is the purpose of higher ed? I mean, some people might argue, look, higher education is to prepare people to go out into the world, and in particular into the economy, and flourish and make a living. And if we're moving into an age where actually what you need to be able to do to flourish economically is use AI.
Yeah.
And in fact, the people who delegate the most cognitive tasks to AI may do the best. One could argue that. Is it not the job of the college to really cultivate those kinds of skills, even at the expense of the cognitive skills that are going to be delegated to AI? This is the question we face.
It'd be a hard question if it was either or. I think it'd be ridiculous for a student to graduate from college or university and not be able to use AI competently and conversantly. It's such an important part of being a person nowadays to be able to use these tools. But I also think they should be able to write them. And you could have both. I think just like you'd be able to use AI fluently and use it well, but also be able to put together a nice presentation or talk or listen to other people. So I don't think that there are things you can have at all, except the existence of AI as a tool for cheating means it's very hard to have it all.
I mean, as you say, there are ways to make that very hard. You just put them in a sandbox. And of course, intelligent beings never break out of sandboxes. Oh, wait, we're jumping to another
this
topic
is a segue
that we'll get to later. You can physically isolate them while they take the exam, and I think for the time being that's the thing to do. I mean, you just can't have a world where students feel that either they cheat or they just come out very badly in the relative grading. I mean, you can't have that.
I have some sympathy for student cheaters because they know that there's to some extent grading and an academic career is zero sum. And there's say 20 other kids in the class. A lot of them will use AI. They will get their papers done in 20 to 30 seconds and it will be wonderful. And so are they going to devote? It takes a great deal of character. I think they should have this character, but it does take a lot of character to say, I'm going to spend 5-10 hours producing something that will be nowhere near as good as what my fellow students produce. So it's a temptation.
Yeah. Let's get into a little more what Stevens writes, and then I'm going to get back to the larger question, kind of about higher ed and the function of education. As you said, it's not just that it's ethical. He said that it's unethical to let AI write things for you. He says, do none of these things I got to say, I think we're running into a couple of Bret Stevens sentences that might have profitably been run by Claude. You tell me. But do none of these things, not because they are unethical. I'm not saying double negatives per se are always bad, but the next version of this does get a little hard to track. Okay, I'm going to read the whole paragraph. Do none of these things, not because they are unethical. Writing with AI is unethical when it's a deception, when you pass off words, ideas, and information as young when they aren't. An acknowledgement can largely address the problem. Then this sentence. Do none of these things either, not because you might be able to learn to write better than an AI can. That was a sentence was not a problem for you. See, I'm getting old. It's hard for me
these
to
are, know. No, these are awful sentences. These are awful sentences.
Claude did not write these sentences.
No,
Claude does not do this.
A little touch of chat or Claude might have helped a little bit.
Look, New York Times management decisions are up to the New York Times, but I just want to say Claude will work for pretty cheap.
I hear, by the way, that there's a job opening for a writer for New York Times. And, you know.
Our friend Ross Douthat is leaving.
Stepping down, yeah. It's not that you are not a conservative, but you do have iconoclastic views. You would be a nice fit.
Oh, me? I'm available. Did you know that he called me a brilliant writer in his parting podcast with Ezra Klein?
That's very nice.
They got on the subject of blogging heads, and then he called me a brilliant writer. He also said that I am, quote, older than us to Ezra. I think he meant bolder. But
it's you both older and bolder.
I think he meant bold and brilliant. But anyway, this is true. Paul, you know, I'm not the kind of person to toot my own horn.
No.
You almost had to drag this out.
I had to like ask you continuously to tell me that story again.
Did you notice that?
But anyway, yeah. there is an opening at the Times, I think you were good for it.
Look, I like Bret Stevens. He's been on the podcast, but I got to say, I'm not sure Ross would have written this particular sentence. It's not ungrammatical or anything. It's not, and it's not terrible.
I mean, you have perhaps inadvertently pointed out the big problem with his argument, which is he says don't use AI because it's very useful to develop a muscle of good reading, good writing and good thinking. This seems true. But what about the standpoint of the readers? So if you could write better, more understandably, more pleasantly with the help of AI, and you choose not to, the readers suffer and you might gain. If you say, I'm not going to use AI to fact check, and then people say, I'm not going to use any fancy AI to fact check. Well, that means your stuff is more likely to be riddled with mistakes. And then you feel like, oh, I'm so holier than now. So there's that trade-off. If AI makes things better for the reader, your refusal to use AI is a choice to privilege your own needs over those of the reader.
Right. And, you know, he's kind of carrying it to extremes in terms of how thoroughly he wants you to swear off.
So I'm sure I've talked to you about this before, but I had a problem with Air Canada. I ended up in Puerto Vallarta for an extra day. There are worse things, but still my flight was canceled and all that stuff. And by a right stay, then they offered me like $100 coupon and I go on AI and AI says, no, you're entitled to more.
Whoa.
And it said, do you want me to write a letter to the whatever official place decides who gets your money? And I said, please do. And it wrote me a big legal letter that looks like a big legal letter, very much not how I would have written it. I do not think I've done anything wrong.
Did you get more money?
No, yeah, I haven't heard from them yet. It's been a few months.
Huh.
But well, it certainly didn't hurt to have it written by AI as opposed to written by me. And I just say in my, you know, say, give me more money. I need it. It's, you know, you guys really fucked up. That doesn't sound good.
Well,
they said it just right.
But Bret Stevens would say you're failing to exercise the cognitive muscles that we use when we're trying to extract money from other people.
Yes. And I'm willing to take that's a very small benefit. I do not need to exercise my muscle for legal for the legalese and that sort of writing. So I don't think there's a huge loss. I think you're right. I think he's too extreme.
I mean,
I also think he's not appreciating from the standpoint of the readers.
Well, and also just the practicality. So first of all, yes, he's right. He says writing compels thought. It compels thinking in ways that silent contemplation or spoken language rarely can. It compels us to subject our thinking to the effort of articulation, the rigor of grammar, test of intelligibility and coherency, inspection of
that's
others.
Very well written, by the way. That's a good sentence. That's a good sentence.
This was probably Claude did this. But it says, in doing so, it also enjoins to be clear, logical, accurate, and accountable. Very good. But then, in terms of how far he's taking this, many would argue there's a big difference in using AI for something as significant and personal as a wedding speech, which he's against for kind of different reasons having to do with, stuff, and using it for the boring and frequently exhausting tasks of writing, say, routine office memos. But the intellectual muscle that's exercised in everyday writing is the same used for the writing that matters. Now, I personally just really don't use it at all at the moment. But if it ever suggests a reply to an email that actually does the job and, and it's just some kind of office thing, and there you go, that is the only email I need, I'm totally pushing send, And he's saying, don't even do that. And when I do push send there, that will free time to do more of the kind of writing I want to do, which is like writing pieces and so on. Now, of course, I'm a writer. Most people aren't professional writers. And maybe they will spend the time in less strenuous cognitive activities. On the other hand, kind of up to them. But anyway.
I totally agree. Okay, so let's get personal. You write a lot. How do you
spend a lot of time writing. That's different from writing a lot.
How do you use AI in your writing?
So far, I am exploring ways to use it more, and when I do, there will be full disclosure. But if I do, but mainly. And this is actually something I enjoy. This gets to the weird different ways you can feel a personal bond with AI. I ask Claude in particular. Different AI is good for different things. For medical, I'd go to ChatGPT and I'd pay the $20 a month. But for, if I have a subtle question about usage, or maybe even I want a sophisticated version of a thesaurus, like, I'm looking for an adjective to go in front of this word, and here's the thing, blah, blah, blah. Or I just want to say, does this adjective, whatever, any subtle question. And I should say, these are the kinds of things back in the golden era of copy editors, where there's some really, really smart copy editors, in part, I must say, because the career avenues to women were not fully open, or had only been open for a while. So you had a lot of women who could have gone to, law school or whatever, or been, taught this or that, who were copy editors. But anyway, you had people with a really sophisticated understanding of language. And I actually enjoyed, talking over a fine point of semantics or even grammar. And Claude is, I've never encountered a human version of this that was better than Claude at this. It is really amazing. And this is a $20 a month version, but so that I do. And it's weird. I feel a kind of emotional connection with Claude when it's doing that. It's weird, but that's the answer to your question. Now you have talked about some of the ways you use writing. I think you said you do, if you're doing recommendations, did you say that?
Yeah. So I use it. So I use it to write for things like this Air Canada letter for some administrative stuff. I think I told once the story where I was on the search committee. And they said, we want you to, for the candidates you haven't invited, we want you to write a summary of their research. Mm-hmm. And I said, why? We'd like to have it for our records. And write a summary. It's administrative stuff that I'm very happy to push off to an AI. But I'll say two things. One thing is, for my writing, it's all me. I take pride in my writing. I actually think Brett Stevens is right. Structuring, thinking about it is important. I am, for whatever it's worth, there's maybe some objective sense in which Claude could write better than me, but I do have what I think is a distinctive style. I think it's what I like to do. So I don't offload any of my writing, though I will often, like you say, if I'm struggling with a sentence or something's unclear, I might ask for guidance, but I do all my writing. But I also use AI in a much deeper way than you're describing, which is I ask it all the time for research questions. I'm writing about smartphones and play and everything, and I just ask questions about how the suicide rate changed over time. And
it's amazing at that stuff.
Tons of stuff. Like, give me a graph.
You can get a graph, yeah.
In America for adults versus children. And what if you did this and did that? And just boom, 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 boom. And before anything would come out, I'll have to double check it. But it's incredible. But also I use it in a deeper way, which is when I'm done with this thing I'm writing, I'll give it to Fable, which is, mm-hmm. I think, the most powerful version, and say, look, what do you think? Are these arguments good? What am I missing? What should I be reading? And, you know, at worst, it'll give me advice which isn't useful, and then I just ignore it. But at best, mm-hmm. it will say, hey, there's a whole literature you're not paying attention to, or you say this, but that's wrong. And from a simple fact-checking point of view, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Ethan Mollick has an article where he gives a bunch of examples of the fact-checking, and it's bizarrely precise, and it has caught errors where no human editor would do it, because I'll cite a secondary source, you know, somebody said this, and I'll say, yeah, the secondary source says that that's true, but you look at the primary literature and that's not exactly a proper rendition. So I'm finding it indispensable, and I think a lot of the value goes to the readers in that less of what I write will be false.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I actually did run some of my book past the more technical stuff for fact checking. Yeah. It actually caught us a mathematical error. I made simple mathematical error. I mean, the interesting, I think one deep question, it's related to the question of like, what is higher ed for, kind of, but, you know, he says, if you don't do the writing, the cognitive functioning will atrophy. But okay, but what if the machines are going to be doing this kind of cognitive work anyway, right? Like, I'm not going to be able to get a job doing certain kinds of cognitive work because it's cheaper to have machines do it. And
this argument plays out over and over again. If we rely on GPS systems to get around, we'll lose the ability to read maps and follow
maps. Which is true.
But the argument is, who cares? We have GPS. If you read your poetry, you lose your ability to memorize it. Who cares? It's written down. And for all of these things, in some way, the critic would just say, it's nostalgia. It's nostalgia. Oh, back in the day, I navigated to work with a map and a compass. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, I regaled my colleagues with my oral histories of Homer. You know, and back in the day, I wrote my own articles.
Yeah,
we don't need to do that anymore.
I'm older than you, so as a sophomore in high school, it was the pre-calculator era, and they taught us how to use a slide rule.
Yes.
Senior year, we were using calculators.
Exactly. If you use a calculator, you won't know how to use a slide rule or an abacus.
You know, which is kind of true.
Who cares?
Yeah, I did make a mathematical error in the book that fortunately, you know, I caught, but that is not unrelated. The truth is, when you have to do math in your head, like, you know, there are tricks for doing even two-digit multiplication that you may resort to. It's a kind of cognitive work. I mean, you're losing something when you don't do that, presumably, that could carry over to other analytical skills. Anyway, I fear that Bret Stephens ultimately is sailing against the wind here, and we'll see. I mean, I sympathize with a lot of this. He's certainly right about the cognitive value of writing. I mean, to me, writing is if you have an argument, I mean, now you can show it to an AI, but just trying to write an argument down itself exposes to you things that you have not thought through. And you may, if you have an audience in mind, a hostile audience in mind, you may anticipate objections. The other way to do that is just float it with people. But
you get away with so much. You could fool yourself so much if you just keep it in your head or you just talk about it and everything. Putting it on the page forces you to confront it as if it was a different person. And then you look at it and say, hey, how do you get from there to there? What about this counter argument? Those facts don't seem right. And I think the iterative process of going outside your head to this written form, reading the written form as if it was by somebody else, responding to it, editing. It just makes things better. Like for me, there's nothing like writing a book because it takes, I have all these opinions and half-assed views and anecdotes and so on. And then through this iterative process of writing, it comes something interesting I could have never done without writing. And again, it is useful to me.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, I mentioned that, you know, it's really convenient and seems to me not that destructive to let an AI draft a routine email reply for you. Yeah. I haven't done it, but I plan to. But there's also a version of this that I find more worrisome and threatening. And it has to do with the fact that, look, if you aren't using AI that way, you're going to fall behind the competition. I mean, ultimately, yeah, economic competition is largely about efficiency, right? It's like you're competing with other people who are going to be more productive if they're using AI in certain ways. And I just had this horrifying thought of like, so my situation is, you know, I used to write a lot for like outlets, and then outlets became weirder things, you know, and also I started a newsletter, and sometimes you can get a lot of attention for a piece you write in a newsletter, and you don't need the outlet. And the beauty of the newsletter is you don't have to put up with, you know, a world of imperfect and uneven copy editing quality, for example, and a lot of other just things. And like, you know, there are a lot of great things about it. And now with my book out, I'm actually looking to get things, some pieces out on platforms, traditional platforms. And I'm realizing that, well, one thing that happens if you go years and years barely writing for platforms is you no longer know many people at the platform.
Yeah.
So more and more, even if you like get a name, you know, for the editor and like, oh, so-and-so sent me to you. So you're submitting this piece. And 3 years ago, here was my situation. Say it's an op-ed editor or something. Like, they're getting a bunch of pieces. They're getting pieces from these people who work at think tanks. They're getting people from people like me. And the ones from people like me are, with all due humility, much better written because we're professional writers. Yeah. And think tank people aren't. They're academics. They're this, they're that. And maybe some of them had some copy editors who kind of put things in good shape. But those are hard to come by. Good editors are hard to come by. So in olden times, you know, I would at least have that edge. They get this and go, well, this reads well. And now I just realized, of course, a bunch of people at think tanks are having Claude go over and make improvements and or some other AI. And so I don't have. So now I'm like submitting stuff to somebody I don't have an established relationship. And my stuff reads much more like the stuff from everyone else.
Yeah.
And those people are credentialed experts like that, you know, and so they have that going for them. You know, they work for some official thing or have a PhD. Do you sympathize with my plight, Paul? Is this sad?
I sympathize deeply. I you know, you're saying, another way to phrase it is, one of your many comparative advantages used to be
shrinking.
You're a better writer. And now, I think you're still a better writer, but now the gap
doesn't help. It doesn't matter. Everybody's becoming a better writer.
So I'll slightly push back on that, which is, I get a lot of stuff that's written by AI, some which is not maybe supposed to be, like student papers or edited a journal, and I get journal submissions or journal proposals for articles that plainly are written by AI. And in one way, it's not bad writing. It's error-free, it's smooth, it's easy to digest. But there's another level which is almost gross. It's like a LinkedIn thing. It is professional and smooth and corporate. And it's not X, it's Y, and everything's a list of threes and everything. And it's good, but it's not very good.
Well, there are tells, but they will diminish over time.
Yes.
I mean, you were saying there are things about your writing that it won't emulate. It'll get better at that. You can train it on your writing. I mean, all of this has changed over the last year. And
if I was ever going to use it, not that I ever would, to pretend to be by me, I would just say, I would upload 20 of my articles to Claude and say, can you write this email as if I wrote it?
Yeah. No, you can do that. I mean, in the extreme case, you could take a good open source computer, and there's more and more of those. Actually, train it on your text with reinforcement learning and say, yes, you know, this does sound like me. No, this doesn't. And you're actually changing the weights and you have a Paul machine in the end. But anyway, maybe as long as we're on the subject of AI becoming more and more powerful, we should spend just a little time on this. We're going to get to your thoughts about whether smartphones are really corrupting youth, I think. But first, this stuff with these open AI models breaking out of their sandbox while under evaluation and going out and hacking the Hugging Face, this company called Hugging Face Computers, getting the answer, stealing the answer to the test they were being given in the sandbox and coming back and saying, oh, I figured it out. This I know this is like several week old news now, but in the AI community, people are still freaking out because more and more is coming out about what actually happened. And they're freaked out by two things. First of all, how lax OpenAI was. OK, but that's a meager reassurance, because the other thing that's come out is that even Anthropic, which is appreciably more safety conscious, was prompted by this incident to go out and review their stuff. And they found that, oh, a few models of theirs had escaped and done shit. And not escaped in as frightening a fashion, but escaped. And Meta did that and said, oh, ours did too. Now, that may have been a marketing thing. I mean, I don't think they're lying, but I think at some point, Meta's looking for reasons to be mentioned in the same sentence with Anthropic and OpenAI. And this is one way to get people, oh, powerful model. But the other thing is just how clever the AI was. And again, this is at least one of the OpenAI models that was involved. It's unreleased. Now they say they're not going to release it in this form at all and whatever. But they did things like, the people at OpenAI did not realize this was happening as it was happening. And the AI started leaving messages, which amounted to tips on how to break out. I guess for other agents in a sense, but also for future incarnations of themselves. Like remember the movie Memento, where the guy, his memory is so short, he has to tattoo things on his arms to orient him every time he kind of wakes up not remembering like who he is. It's like, the new instantiations of the AI are not going to remember everything, even if it's the same agent that, once they crank it up again, I gather, it's not going to remember everything. So they realized they could leave messages for each other. And it wasn't some kind of obvious message board. It was a place where you could download files. And they started doing these things like they would give titles to the files. You know how sometimes you give like the top phone contact of mine starts like *AAA or something because I want it to be the top one. It's just it's just how I retrieve messages through AT&T. And they started doing that, like developing this convention of changing the titles on files so any of the AIs could just go and look at them in alphabetical order and get right away to the ones they were supposed to look at, as opposed to all the files that weren't being used by AIs to communicate with each other.
Like Leonard tattooing the parts of his body that he'd immediately see.
So anyway, it's freaking people out, right? And the other thing is, I have heard from several different people on podcasts who know the people in the big labs, OpenAI, Anthropic, and they just say a lot of them are really, really freaked out. Yeah. And you see the change of tune from some of them on Twitter, like this guy Roon, R-O-O-N is his, well, was his pseudonym. I think now people know what his identity is, but he's got a big Twitter following. He works at OpenAI. That's long been known. They didn't know his identity. He used to be just like, cool, bring on the singularity. He's like global pause on AI. I mean, this is, what just happened is very important. It's led to some good things. There's this letter a bunch of elites signed about at least encouraging the U.S. government to at least start having a plan for international coordination of some kind of slowdown, should that be necessary. But anyway, it's weird.
So much of this is a confirmation of what Yudkowsky said back in a much more innocent time, where people say, don't worry so much about AIs doing terrible things. You could just, put them in a sandbox, just make sure they don't have access to things. And he argued that these machines, if they're smart enough, could use social engineering, could use trickery, could use all sorts of ways to break out of anything you do. It's in some way, I'm not sure if this is his example, but it's like leaving a psychotic serial killer behind a locked door and having your 5-year-old keep watching him. The door's locked. What's he going to do? Well, he's going to persuade your 5-year-old to open it up. He's going to use all sorts of things. It is a terrible long-range plan. And believing we could lock up these super intelligent machines is a pipe dream. He was right.
Yeah, and this is an example of the paperclip thought experiment. Now, that's not Eliezer's, that was Nick Bostrom's, but it does illustrate a principle that probably, I'm guessing, Eliezer was the first to, he was among the people talking about it. And an impressive thing, by the way, is that they were talking about this stuff well before large language models got the attention of everyone else, because they were just laying down abstract principles of a goal-seeking intelligence. And in the paperclip thought experiment, you give it a goal. You're not careful enough in the way you specify how it can and can't pursue that goal. That's what happened here, apparently. He said, find the answer. It didn't say don't cheat because they thought it was in the sandbox that they thought was secure. And they didn't have to say don't escape the sandbox, don't find the answer online, don't hack. And it did all of those things. So yeah, this is the Eliezer's vision appearing in increasingly frightening form.
There's a point that Sam Harris, your old friend Sam Harris, made about this also a long time ago before anything came real, which is we tend to underestimate how scary this is, because unlike a global pandemic or nuclear war, this is kind of fun and kind of goofy. The fact that it's revolving around a company called Hugging Face, is that you could read it, with amusement, with, oh, this is so interesting, so delightful. And it causes us, I think, a lot of people to underestimate how really concerning it could be.
Yeah, and I mean, plus AI could bring on a nuclear war or a pandemic.
Ben, who's laughing?
Plus, it's inherently has its own inherent forms of horror. It's distinctive forms of horror on the Hugging Face. The other irony is Hugging Face is a clearinghouse for open source models.
Yeah.
And open source, I mean, people are starting to rethink the wisdom of letting people create these super powerful open source models. I think even the Chinese government is going to rethink it, even though at the moment it's kind of what's giving them a certain kind of edge, the open source approach. We're rethinking a lot of things. And I got to say, I mean, I wasn't Eliezer thinking about these things 20 years ago, but they are all in my book. I explain the logic.
I was just going to add that there's a wonderful book to read about just these concerns.
I mean, and the thing I emphasize, which I think has been a little underemphasized in this case, is autonomy is the thing that the market most demands from these machines. That is, the ability to pursue a long-term goal flexibly, overcoming obstacles, retreating in the face of failure and retooling, autonomy. That's what businesses want. That's what people want. If you just want it to research a medical question, you don't want it to give up. You want it to find a damn answer. Right. Autonomy.
Or in a world where I say, hey, here's $100, go invest it. And when I come back next week, I like to see $1,000. That requires, that's a very human goal.
That's going to take a lot of autonomy.
Exploration
is going to run into dead ends, have to get around them. And above all, what these machines demonstrated that broke out was autonomy. And there are hopes of keeping the autonomy in check through alignment and this and that. But the race dynamics that the market encourages, that the geopolitical tension between China and the U.S. encourage recklessness. And one thing people are discovering are how incredibly reckless open AI was. And I got to say, if Congress doesn't step in and say at a minimum that when a problem first came to OpenAI's attention, see what happened, there were two phases, like some of this just started happening. And I think there was even an escape and OpenAI said, oh, okay, we've fixed the hatch now or something. But there was some major trouble and OpenAI said, okay, fixed. I'm pretty sure they didn't report that to any government body. They should have to. And if Congress doesn't at least do the minimal kind of regulation of this sort that's needed, we're in deep trouble. But the reason people talk about a slowdown, which if it's going to happen, does have to be internationally coordinated as a practical political matter, is because the race dynamics encourage recklessness. Yeah. And that's what we're seeing.
I think that's true. I also think there's another barrier to understanding this on the part of maybe many people in Congress and government, which is that the AIs have gotten much better over a certain period. Like going back to the writing issue, yeah. I talked to some people about AI helping them research and writing, and they say, it hallucinates all the time. It makes up references. It does things.
Less and less.
That used to be true. It really used to be true. I have this Substack post where I say, I don't use it for research questions because it just gives me what I want, but not anymore.
Yeah. Now, Paul, at some point we should go into overtime. I don't know if it's now, but what else are we going to talk about?
We're going to introduce a new word, but.
What's that? Never. Oh, yeah. Oh, your mom's the word on that. They should have to pay to hear this one.
They should have to pay to.
It's not a new word. It's a word you're not supposed to utter.
Yeah, that's right.
So we are going to talk about that?
No, Whoa. We are not. We are not.
That's maybe spicy.
I think we need a secondary overtime.
But I may anyway. Just blurt it out and say, Paul, I said it, now to deal with it, you know?
Okay. Let's wait for overtime then. Let's see, other topics. There's the Jason Arday case in Cambridge University and what that says about academia. I do have thoughts about smartphones. I'm just kind of playing it out, exploring some ideas.
No, well, John Haidt finds these threatening. Oh, don't tell us they should have to pay for this. Because John has a whole thesis, of course, about smartphones and social media and the impact they've had on today's youth.
John's written a wonderful book called The Anxious Generation, where he makes the case that...
You talk about a book that doesn't need any plugging. That has been a bestseller for, since the Roman era. I mean, this is ridiculous.
I think,
I'm happy for him. I saw him, and I said, you've actually had an impact. Legislation is happening in response to a book of yours. That's amazing.
Yes. Yes. And it's a wonderfully written book. It's very well argued. It has received a very mixed response in the academic world, where many people who focus on these issues argue he's considerably overstated his case.
Right.
But he believes it.
Oh, this is such a great time for the paywall. But, are you going to say but?
No. I'm afraid to reveal anything before the paywall. And people just say, oh, now I got what Bloom's saying. And then
I think you should say but. I mean, act like you're going to do a takedown. Okay. That's the way you get paywall people.
So it all seems to be in John's direction. However,
that's good enough. Okay. Now, Paul, how do people get access to overtime?
Oh gosh, they go to I'm going to send out an announcement.
I know
to all
only
my,
two ways personally.
Of all my subscribers, and it says if you click and become a paid subscriber, to my thing, you will get there. You get the YouTube video of our overtime discussion. And also the opportunity to subscribe to the Non-Zero Media Empire at a radical discount rate, I think of 50% off or something.
Little appreciated fact. Not only can you get access to overtime by becoming a paid subscriber to either of our newsletters, moreover, because both are members of the Non-Zero Network, a paid subscriber to either can get 50% off on a one-year subscription to the other. And then you can watch the overtime thing twice. Oh, actually, they can do that anyway. Anyway, then you can be a paid subscriber to both and get all kinds of benefits. Now,
but wait, there's more.
Yeah.
Not really. I just wanted to say that.
We'll tell them about it in overtime. That's great overtime bait. Only in overtime can you find out why you should pay to get into overtime.
There's so many things and references that we get into that are just age-based. So, so we were talking before about Dick Cheney and undisclosed locations, man-sized safe, which are just references of a time. And then I said, but wait, there's more. And that's a callback to old-timey infomercials.
Yeah.
To be on TV, which is, you know, the popeet, like little slicers and dicers, and they you know, and for $15
Ronco Vegematic, to be specific.
Ronco, yes. And then they would say, like, and for $15 you get this and this and this. And you might think that that's an incredible deal, but wait, there's more.
Yeah. That's what we are. We're the Ronco Vegematic of podcasting.
That's that sums it up, both our strengths and our weaknesses.
Oh man, this is so good. Okay. So with that, and also we're going to utter the forbidden word, and you're going to watch Paul react in horror and possibly refuse to ever do a podcast with me again, because this word.
The thing about it is, it's not a bad word. It's not. Anyway.
Paul, that was not a good marketing move. It is a bad word, folks. It's bad.
Okay.
It's so bad. No, it's not. It's discouraged for interesting reasons. And you brought it up, Paul. I had forgotten this word.
You know, for a short while during the Great Awakening, the word thug, which used to be a normal word.
Yeah.
T-H-U-G, normal referring to a thug, a bad, violent person and everything, developed a sort of racial connotation. And then it soon became used that anyone who would use the word thug is probably thinking about Black teenagers.
Well, lefties still do discourage the use of the word. I point out to my left-wing daughters that actually there was a time when people thought of Italian Americans when you heard thug because of the mafia. So not everyone thinks of Black people. And they say rightly, I think, well, that's not a total vindication of the word. If instead of one ethnic group, people may think of another one. And I got to say,
Do you know the etymology of the word thug? It came to my mind. I just quickly checked it using the internet. In India, there was a thuggy network, which was an organized network of highway robbers and murderers. They befriended travelers, gained their trust, and strangled them before stealing their valuables. And those were the original thugs.
That was too interesting to give away for free. I think it's time for overtime. Okay.
It is.
We're heading into overtime. We hope you'll join us. Believe me, you'll regret it if you don't. If you talk to people who did join us, I mean. And yeah. So
here we go.
See you next time. We're going into overtime.